find employees that are happy with their job and they're productive and they not only want a paycheck, but they want a job. It's really hard to find good help these days, isn't it? And we, as Christians, need to be reminded of our responsibility as employees. That's what 1 Timothy chapter 6, the application of it, the first two verses, is about. And so, this lesson, and my plan is to finish it up tonight, I've entitled The Conscientious Christian Employee. The Conscientious Christian Employee. Question. Did God originally intend for man to work? Did God originally intend for man to work? How many say yes? How many say no? We're not quite half and half, but we're not too far from it. Genesis chapter 2, verse 5. You know, it's really amazing how many times we've read across some things and it didn't dawn on us. And we go back and somebody points it out and we think, man, how many times have I read that? Genesis chapter 2, verse 5. Now, no shrub had yet appeared on the earth, and no plant had yet sprung up, for the Lord God had not sent rain on the earth, and there was no one to work the ground. The King James says, till the soil, I think. Till the ground? The word till is not even implied there. It is that the translators put their thought into what he meant when he said to work the ground. And so they put till. But the word, this straight out translated, is to work the ground or the soil. So there was two reasons, he says, that there was no greenery, no shrubbery on the earth. One was God hadn't yet sent rain. Second one was what? There was no Adam. The word Adam means man. There was no Adam. There was no man to work the ground. So, Genesis chapter 2, verse 15. And by the way, between verse 5 and verse 15, he solved the problem with the water. He said that he had rivers that came and watered the whole face of the ground. All right, so he solved the water problem. Now he's going to solve the man problem, and he creates a man in chapter 2, verse 15. The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to do what? Work it and keep it. Now, following sin's entrance into the world, now we're in Genesis chapter 3, verse 17. To man, to Adam, he said, because, and I'm in 3:17, because you listened to your wife and ate the fruit of the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat from it. Cursed is the ground because of you. And then here's the curse. Through painful toil, you will eat food from it all the days of your life. And then he starts talking about sweating, sweat of your brow. And that's a new word, painful toil. It's translated in the New International Version. And that word is different from the word work. The first one meant service. To render a service. To work. This one is a much more intense word. It means painful toil. And so the curse is not that you're going to have to work. The curse is that this work that you're going to be involved in is going to be laborious toil. Consequently, people don't like their job because it is laborious or painful toil. Now, by the way, we talk about, I'm not going to go there. There were two curses and then there were two judgments. We talk about the, and I talk about the curse that God put on woman and the curse that God put on man. The Bible doesn't use those words in connection with what he said to the man and what he said to the woman. He does with the serpent. He's going to curse the serpent. He's going to curse the ground. But he's going to pass a judgment on the man and the woman. But that curse that was put particularly on the soil is going to affect your everyday life. So my first point is, to answer my original question, God originally intended for man to work, to serve. But that was a good word. And it was a good thing. It was not a painful thing. It was not a laborious thing. Unfortunately, after sin came, that pleasant work became laborious because of sin. It was going to be hard to scratch out a living from that point on. Point number two. Point number one was God intended for man to work. Point number two, God designed man's work to be an expression of service to God. God originally designed work to be an expression of service to God. He was doing something for God when God told him, I'm going to put you in the garden and here's what I want you to do. When he did that, he was doing something for God. And he felt that. We in this fallen world have, and it has become such a part of our nature, we don't even recognize it. We have separated secular from sacred, church and state, if you will. We have separated our lives. We've drawn a line in this world and in our individual personal lives, and on one side of it is what we offer to God, and the other part is us and our family and the real world and the secular world. And we've created problems for ourselves, lots of problems for ourselves, psychologically and every other way, even physically. We've created problems for ourselves by drawing a line that separates mine over here and God's over here. I used to hear people talk a lot about God's money and my money. And God's money was what? The money that went into the collection plate, right? And what was left was my money. Now, you set yourself up for failure when that's your attitude. And I can tell you this, there have been lots and lots and lots of churches that split over how God's money was used. Now, how I use my money and how you use your money is nobody's business, right? But how God's money is used is everybody's business. Everybody but God, that is. And there's been lots of churches that's been split over the use of God's money. Really, really interesting, and it probably is very telling about us that that would be the kind of things that we would get all upset and split and divide over how money is used. We have created large numbers of problems, and the first thing that we need to do, and this is kind of a nuts and bolts thing, but instead of drawing a line, we need to make our line a circle. And we need to draw a circle in our life. And everything that we have and are and ever hope to have and ever hope to be goes inside that circle. And across the label of that circle is God's. It's all God's. There's no line. God didn't intend for there to be a line that separates his and mine. We have a circle as Christians. Now, we had a whole series of lessons on that some 3 or 4 years back, talking about that everything that we do, there is a biblical sense in which everything that we do is worship to God. We offer everything. I'm not going to go back and try to, you can go back and get the series of lessons and listen to it if you would like to. A New Testament Concept of Worship is the title of it, if you'd like to get that series. But we really create problems for ourselves. And it's an extremely selfish thing to do. And it really addresses our heart whenever, and maybe that's not quite true. Maybe it addresses what we've been taught all of our life. And we need to stop and rethink this thing, that we have some part of this is God's and some part of it's mine, because by implication, I can spend mine and do whatever I want to with mine as long as I give God his. And that's not an uncommon attitude among people. And sometimes even Christians take part of mine and do something that they know God wouldn't approve of, but I've washed it, I've laundered it, because I gave God his. You understand? You with me? What I'm saying? We do that same thing with our time. I give God his time. I give God his this. And so then that legitimizes me to do whatever I want to with mine. I don't find that concept anywhere in the Bible. But it's become such a part of our thinking that we don't even realize that we've done that. We don't even realize that it's wrong. That everything that we have is God's. And so, everything in my life, God intended to be an expression of my relationship to God, including my work. Everything in my life is an expression of my relationship to Him, including my work. How I work, whether or not, how honest I am, how much I give this person in relation to what I have agreed to do, if I cut corners, how I speak, how I act, all of those things are an expression of my relationship to God. And not just my work, but my work is included in that. Therefore, work becomes something of a sacred duty. And to do anything less than that is to be idolatrous. What is idolatry? Putting something else in the place of God. So if you pay God off so that you can have whatever percentage of your time, energy, money, talents, whatever to use for yourself, then that part of your life, you've set God aside. And that at least smacks of idolatry. Now, this is kind of radical thinking, I know. But if we were to be able to go back to the very beginning and not have all this baggage that we've brought over the years and that our society and so forth that we brought to our way of thinking, then I think things would be much, much, much simpler as they were for Adam and Eve in the garden. William Tyndale said, there is difference between washing dishes. He actually said betwixt, but some people don't know what betwixt means. So there's a difference between washing dishes and preaching the word of God, but as touching pleasing God, there is no difference at all. Let me read it again. There is difference between washing dishes and preaching the word of God, but as touching pleasing God, there is no difference at all. In other words, the implication being, whatever you do, do it unto the Lord. Right? Everything that we do, we offer it to the Lord. Now, I want to take this a step further. Every task that we perform is an expression of our relationship to God. It's an expression of your faith. Everything that you do expresses your faith, or if you choose to disregard that, it expresses your lack of faith. Everything in our life is an expression of our faith. Our day-to-day life is how we live out what we believe, right? That's how we demonstrate to the world what we believe, how we live every day. And that includes our work. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 31 is one of our passages. Whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, do it all to the glory of God. Everything that you do it as if, because it is in fact what you're doing, as if you're giving this to God. You're doing this for God. Now, while we're bringing our attitude in line with God's will, let's flip the coin over here for just a minute. Because our attitude toward our work has such potential for good, that then it inherently has that much potential for bad. If you can affect people positively by expressing your faith in your work, then not doing that also is going to do the very opposite, isn't it? It's going to, as Paul will write to the Jewish Christians, the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentile because of you. Because they look at you and they see what you do and they see what you don't do and they see how you talk and they see your attitude and they say, if that's what your God and following your God's all about, thanks but no thanks. I don't want any part of it. And so, there's a flip side to it. Our work is the strongest influence that we have in day in and day out to influence the people around us. The way that we work, the way that we act when we work, and our attitude about it. So, our concern about our job, and this is pretty radical, I know it is, but our concern about our job should not primarily focus on how it benefits me, but on how it benefits those people around me, how it affects those people around me. How do we think about our job? When we think about our job, we pretty much think about it just in terms relative to myself, right? Am I getting what I deserve? Am I getting the pay? Or these people that I work with, how do they affect me? And they make me angry. And, you know, it's me. Am I going to get a raise? Am I going to get this? Or this person got, you know, this raise and I didn't get one or whatever. It's all about me. I would suggest that if we really want to affect the world, we need to start viewing our jobs not solely, at least from my perspective, but from others' perspective. And how my work and my attitude benefits those around me. As What if we saw our jobs, if we truly viewed our jobs as a way to serve God and a way to influence other people for the kingdom? What if that was the way when we thought about our job, that was the things that we thought about? Would we be different people on the job? If we were offering this and when we went to work, we were saying, God, I'm going to conduct myself in such a way that you're going to be proud of me and I'm going to influence other people around me so that they'll want to be a Christian too. What if that was our prayer, the way we started our work day off? And that was our prayer throughout the day. That changes everything, doesn't it? And I'm going to say that until and unless you understand these principles or see 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 1 and 2, in this light, you can't understand what he's saying. You have to understand that, I believe, to really get the message of what he says in 1 Timothy 6, 1 and 2. And there's one more thing. I want to spend a little bit of time on one more thing that keeps us from understanding or fully appreciating and accurately applying these verses. Namely, our understanding of master-slave relationship. This verse doesn't have the intended impact on our lives because we have the attitude and the understanding that we do about a slave. And so I want to spend a little bit of time talking about a slave in the biblical context, and in the historical context. of the people of that time. When we think of a slave, we think of an abusive relationship that existed in, let's just say, the American plantation system, up and down the Mississippi River in the plantation system, particularly in the South. When we think of a slave, that's what comes to our mind, right? We generally think of a black man who has chains on or who has scars on his back because he's been beaten. He has been abused. And that's what comes to our mind. And so there is nothing about the concept of being a slave that is attractive in any way to us. And so because of that, and when we come to read this about those who are under the yoke of slavery should consider their masters worthy of respect, and we read the instructions that Paul gives to masters and to slaves, then that's what comes to our mind. We think of someone who's been oppressed, somebody who perhaps has been treated like an animal. I grew up in the Deep South. I grew up in the Mississippi Delta. I had one of my good friends lived in and was a caretaker. His family, mom and dad, were caretakers for one of the plantation houses in Natchez, Mississippi. I used to go over and play with him when I was a little kid at his house, and we would go down to the bottom of that house, and there was a room that still had the iron rings that were embedded in the walls where they chained slaves at night. I didn't think anything about it. That was just the house he lived in. That's what I grew up with. Right? So I understand. I know people who were killed because their skin was the wrong color. I'm very familiar with it. I was going to high school about halfway through high school when schools were integrated. And integration was really, really a hard, terrible thing. In the town that I grew up in. And I'm not going to tell you all the tales about it, but there were some really horrific atrocities that were committed during that time. And so we bring to this concept of slave master, we bring something to this that keeps us from being able to understand it. And quite frankly, when we read about slavery in the Old Testament, we read the instructions in Leviticus and Deuteronomy that were given to God's people whenever they took captured people and so forth. When we read about that they were allowed to take slaves and so forth, quite frankly, we're offended. And we really might be offended at God that he didn't stop or at least teach against such a practice. But that, because the Bible doesn't condemn that master-slave relationship, that's a classic illustration of our cultural bias, keeping us so that we have ears that don't hear and eyes that don't see what is taught in regard to this. In New Testament setting, the economic system of master-slave was a form of contracted employment. Let's start right there. It was a form of contracted employment. There were numerous ways that somebody could become a doulos, a slave. Could have been captured in war. And rather than being killed, would be spared to serve somebody for a particular purpose. Daniel would have been an example of this. Daniel chapter 1, verse 1. And then the first chapter or so talks about in war, they were captured and they took these outstanding young men, Nebuchadnezzar did, and brought them over to his homeland, and he sent them to school. He prepared them so to be in his service. There's an illustration of it. Now, it wasn't, they didn't come and ask Daniel if he wanted to go over to Babylonia, did they? But he was taken as a slave. There's an illustration. That would be the bottom rung of the ladder. We read in the Old Testament about parents being allowed to and given instructions about indenturing their children. They could sell, quote, their children to someone, maybe for whatever purpose. A widow whose husband had died and left her with a debt and she couldn't pay that debt off, it was not an uncommon practice that she would give her children for a period of time of service in order to pay that debt off. Or a person who found himself in dire circumstances could indenture himself in that same way. And it could be for a long time, it could be for a short time. By the way, if you were a Hebrew, if you were a Jew, then does anybody know the longest period of time that you could serve as a slave? On the Sabbath year, you were released. So the longest that you could serve would be 6 years. Now, you could re-up yourself if you needed to slash wanted to, but at the end of 6 years on the Sabbath year, you were released. Granted, there were certain abuses. There were many abuses and wrong attitudes that developed. But the problem, and I'm going to keep reiterating this, the problem is due to the hearts of men rather than the nature of the system. The system provided security, it provided honest work, it provided fair wages. A slave was provided with all of his needs, they were met, plus all of the needs of his family, including food and clothing and housing. And if you were indentured to or a slave to a Hebrew, you got a day off every week because they were commanded to let even their slaves. They couldn't work on the Sabbath day. If the system was not abused, the slave was better off than a day laborer. You come to the New Testament and you have a number of instructions that are given regarding day laborers. You pay a laborer on the day that he works. Don't you withhold it from him. Don't tell him you're going to pay him sometime later. Every day that he works, you pay him at the end of the day. That was the instructions that was given. You had instructions like if you take a worker's coat as pledge, don't keep it overnight because he might need it that night. It might be cold that night, so you give it back to him. Day laborers were paid an average of one denarii a day. And that's it. There were no perks. There was no insurance. There was no food. There was no anything else. You contracted, you got one denarii a day on the average. A day laborer works. Let's make a comparison here. A day laborer works 6 days a week. Not allowed to work seven. So he earns six denarii a week, assuming he is able to find work every day. And that's a big assumption, right? That every single day, during harvest time, certainly he could find work. During other times, he could find work. But there very likely were times when he was unable to find a job. And so let's say he got six denarii a day. This equals 312 denarii a year. And I ran across this somewhere, and I can't verify it. I can't go back and say this is absolutely true, but this is the comparison that I read. Per year, he paid 184 denarii for food. He paid between 5 and 10 denarii for clothing. Now, if he had a family, obviously, he's going to pay more than that for clothing, right? And that's not going to buy him very good clothing. Plus, he pays 90 denarii a year for housing. That equals 279 denarii and leaves him less than 35 denarii to spend on other needs for the entire year. That is, if he works every single day. If he doesn't get sick, if he gets sick and he's not on a job, he don't get paid. He's not working, he don't get paid. And so assuming that he was healthy enough that he could work every day of the year and that he got work every day of the year, he's going to just be living hand to mouth, isn't he? is just barely going to be making it. Slaves, on the other hand, received all of their food. They received their clothing. They received a house, often in the master's house. Plus, he received a stipend for his own spending money. All guaranteed, whether he was sick or whether he wasn't sick. And this was for his entire family. The system was not evil. God did not speak against the system. He did speak and cause his messengers to speak against the abuses in the system. From both sides. There were abuses from the slave side. There were abuses from the master side. But the problem was not the system. The problem was men's hearts. You see, abuse disappears when the attitude of men's hearts are correct. For instance, love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your mind, and with all of your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. If we all observe that, then the abuses are gone. We're going to treat one another as we would like to be treated. Right? The Bible is filled with instructions. And that's why when Jesus came, he didn't attack the system. He came to change men's hearts. Because you see, you can be a Christian and be a communist. You can be a Christian and be a slave. You can be a Christian and be an employer or an employee. You can be a Christian under any system. Now, there are some that would make it easier than others, but that's life, right? And by the way, let's bring this a little bit closer to home. And we could talk about this for a long time. I'll only talk about it for a moment. We have abuses to our system of employer-employee also, don't we? I mean, we could talk about the formation of unions and why they were formed. And then we could talk about the abuses of unions once they were formed, right? We got problems with our own system. You see, it's so ingrained in us that we think that this is the only way that that God designed this form of government. You can be a Christian under a monarchy, can't you? And so he didn't come to change the system. In the early days of our own country, there was a common practice called indenture, which allowed a person, particularly from Europe, and it seems particularly from Britain or Germany, to come to the United States in exchange for a period of service. And I'm going to put a copy. I ran across a copy of one of those. This is signed by a young man by the name of Henry Meyer in 1737. And this is a contract that paid his passage from Rotterdam in the Netherlands. And it guaranteed, now it's hard to read. You know, it's probably pretty grainy up there, but even the original that I had was pretty difficult to read, and the language doesn't make it any easier, but it guaranteed him certain rights, and it guaranteed him payment, and he agrees in turn to serve, quote, faithfully, obediently, honestly, as a good and dutiful servant ought to do. Now, that's in those lines right up there. It took me a little while to get that sorted out, but that's a quote from that contract there. To serve faithfully, obediently, and honestly as a good and dutiful servant ought to do. It guarantees that at the end of 3 years, he's going to be given certain provisions and set free. And so he's indentured for 3 years. And the U.S. laws and the U.S. courts recognize and enforce this indenture. So, when you wonder why the Bible seems indifferent to to or even supportive of slavery. And that gives lots of people today in our society a good excuse to go back and just out of hand reject the Bible as a whole. This is one of the things that really gives people heartburn today, because they say, you serve a God who supported slavery, and we know what slavery was like. So when you wonder why the Bible seems at best indifferent, or perhaps more specifically supportive of slavery, don't assume that this is analogous to the abusive slavery system that developed in the southern plantation system. It's not the same. Now, am I saying that there were not abuses? No, there were horrible abuses. The Romans really abused their prisoners and their slaves. And others did. But the system itself was not and is not evil. It was a social structure that was advantageous to both properties. Now, if I was going to ever run for public office, and this is on tape, then I would just have shot my chances to ever be elected to any public office, because somebody would get a hold of this and say, well, I can tell you this preacher is supportive of slavery. I'm going to say again, the system was not the problem. It was a mutually... the slavery that he is talking about when he addresses those of you who are under yoke of slavery, when he addresses that, this is an economic system that was advantageous to both parties. Jesus did not come to overturn social order. He came to change men's hearts. But because men's hearts are evil, the system was abused in some societies, including our own. Jesus addresses those abuses. Think about this. Is it not telling to you that the Apostle Paul regularly referred to himself as a slave of Jesus Christ? He did so with pride. A slave of the gospel. In fact, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 19, Paul says, though I am free and belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. And so does Peter, and so does James, and so does Jude. All of them refer to themselves as slaves. Now, if we're going to understand this passage, and Lord willing, we'll get to it tonight. If we're going to understand this passage, we're going to have to understand some of these things. There's a number of places in the New Testament that refer directly, address the master-slave relationship. And one of them is 1 Corinthians chapter 7. I know the bell's rung and I was going to walk through it, but I won't. I'll just bring this point out. And the first part of it, he says, if you were a slave when you were called to Christ, you became a Christian, don't worry about it. Don't use your Christianity as a means to gain your freedom. He says, if you were free whenever you were called and you became a Christian, realize that you're not really free. You were bought with a price. In other words, you are a slave. And then he will say, if you're free, don't become a slave to men. And we don't have time to talk about why he would say that, except you're going to have divided loyalties if you do that. But the implication here is, and don't miss it, you have a choice about whether or not you're going to become a slave or not. So in that historical context, the slave-master relationship was not an evil thing. In fact, a person... You know, I hate to bring this up, but if any of you watch Downton Abbey, you see a little bit more of a slave relationship that the slaves, quote, didn't view themselves in a negative light because of that. But they took pride in the fact that they were a part of this family, and that was a part of that social system. That's much more what is being addressed here in the first century than what we think of as the abusive relationship and situation that occurred in our own country in our past history. So with that, we'll get to the text. And now, by the way, I want other people to understand this some, so if you're here tonight, and I hope you are, you're going to have to bear through a little bit of me going back and rehearsing this, not to this length, but going back and at least touching on this to set it up for understanding this tonight. Thank you. God bless you. I am Sam.